Hey, welcome to the ID10T podcast number 965. So, Seattle, we added a second show to the Neptune Theater October 26th. There's an early show and a late show now. Tickets just went on sale today. They're available at Ticketmaster.com, or you can probably navigate to there through the Neptune Theater's website. But yeah, second show. And again, I'm hoping people come in costume and hopefully we'll give out candy, and I'll try to figure out if there's some kind of Halloween-y stuff that we can do, because you all will be celebrating Halloween that weekend. Halloween's on a Wednesday this year, so hopefully you'll just start celebrating on Friday and go all the way through Wednesday. Actually, hopefully you'll just start celebrating on October 1st and go all the way through October 31st, which is kind of what my wife and I do. So yeah, join us. And I promise we'll have fun. Maybe we'll do a costume contest. Maybe we'll do a costume contest in the first show, and the winner of that we'll put up against the winner of the costume contest in the second show. That'd be kind of fun. I think that'd be really fun. So, yeah. So join me there in Seattle. And then also we'll be announcing the ID10T lineup for the festival this year at the OC Fair and Event Center in Costa Mesa. That is ID10T.com, and we'll announce in a couple weeks, sometime around second or third week of June. Now, for the corkboard, from the goings-on of you, the ID10T listeners, this comes from Tony C., who says, I've been a long-time listener, and so far I've heard Chris say go out and make a thing. Good. I rolled the dice, left my government job, and started Bite Club. I specialize in making small-batch artisan jerky. All of our products are preservative-free, all can be made gluten-free, and I can even make vegan jerky. We can make healthy organic treats for dogs and cats. Newest flavors are Szechuan, inspired by Rick and Morty, and Citrus Sriracha, hipster dream jerky, he says. We are closely work with Chicago-based animal rescues and often sponsor their adoption fees so people can adopt their forever baby at no initial cost. So every bag of jerky purchased helps support rescue animals. Grab a bag for you and your furry best friend. Find us at BiteClubNoms.com on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at BiteClubNoms. This is from Momin, who says, again, you always say just make a thing. I'm glad some of you are listening to that. And my two best friends have done that. Sunita and Pamela Pal have self-published their second children's storybook called My Superhero, about a young girl describing her favorite superhero. And spoiler alert, the superhero is her mom. Sunita and Pamela are both sisters, elementary school teachers, big nerds, and the kindest and coolest people I know. They spent their own money to make this happen. It'd be awesome if you could spread the word. So here we are, spreading the word. If you want to copy their book, you can simply search Sunita Pal on Amazon, and both the ebook and hard copy versions should come up. This episode is Claire Danes. Oh, she was so much fun to talk to. What a chill, just like a regular lady. And definitely someone that I feel like my wife and I could go antiquing with, she and her husband, because we like old stuff. It turns out we both like old stuff. Still doing the podcast out of my house until the new studio is built, so people get to catch a glimpse of all the fun, weird, museum-y pieces we have. Claire's promoting her new movie, A Kid Like Jake, which is in theaters now. You should go watch it. It was directed by Silas Howard, and Jim Parsons was in it as well. So A Kid Like Jake, go see it. Support Claire Danes, support Silas, support Jim Parsons. Oh, one thing I forgot to bring up in the podcast is that Claire Danes and I were in a movie together, sort of, a little movie called Terminator 3 Rise of the Machines. Claire Danes had a part in that movie, but I feel like I played the pivotal role of engineer number two, because really, the film wouldn't have had this drive that it had if I hadn't said that all of the computer systems are down. So I'm just saying I had a very important role in this movie. And I totally forgot to bring it up. Although, what was I have said? Hey, I was in T3, and then she would have been like, good for you. And I would have been like, okay, moving on. But anyway, she was fantastic. So here is Claire Danes on episode 965 of the ID10T podcast. And now, Katie, please roll the machines.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Oh, it's my wife and I collect a lot of weird movie props and stuff.
Oh, okay.
And it's from Hitchhiker's Guide.
Oh.
It was built by the Henson Creature Shop.
Oh, amazing.
So it was in the one with Sam Rockwell. I wouldn't close that. It gets real hot.
Oh, okay.
The oxygen will just disappear from the room. Yeah, so I just got him, and so I have to. He just needs some repairs, so there's a shop that'll like.
Oh, do cool. Some repairs where do you put them? Everywhere?
Well, downstairs is really kind of the.
It's like a gallery.
It's like the TV room.
Right.
But there's all sorts of movie props and weird stuff down the horror movie props and stuff.
Did you both share this preoccupation?
Did. Yes, we did.
It's why you are together.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
It's funny because people online all the time, like when I'll post stuff, they'll go, "Oh, I bet your wife loves that." I'm like, she likes this stuff too. Like
yeah,
this idea that.
Do you have slightly different tastes?
No.
Right. Yeah.
The sort of the delineation is that she tends to collect more horror movie props.
Oh, really?
And I tend to collect more Disney sci-fi and comedy props.
Okay.
So I have stuff from like Spaceballs and Three Amigos and Back to the Future and Doctor Who.
Oh,
and
that's cool.
She has original Gremlins and original.
What are their sources? Where do you find your stuff?
Mostly auctions.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The auction business now is insane because of the internet.
Uh-huh.
So there's a different entertainment auction every week where it's like, this was from Ghostbusters and this was from this thing. And so, yeah.
That's fun.
So that's sort of what nerds do when they make money. They just buy weird movie props from things that they liked when they were kids.
Yes.
Do you collect anything?
Because Homeland moves around constantly, I have to set up, residences.
Of course.
Every other second, it feels like. So I've gotten in the habit of homemaking, and that has become, So I think that's my go-to. But I'm running out of stuff to buy. I mean, So any excuse.
What's your number one? Like, when I go to a new place, I have to have this one thing so I feel like I'm in control of my space.
It depends on the place. But I love getting assignments from friends. Like, if they're moving, I get very excited. Like, give me a project. Tell me what kind of rug to find.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Or, I don't know, anything. But, yeah, Cherish, eBay,
Cherish is
Etsy,
great.
First dibs. Overpriced, but you can bargain.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, overpriced. But people don't know that you can negotiate.
You can negotiate, but then also... But it's weird because... Okay, here we go. Because, you know, almost everything in our house is antique.
Right.
So a lot of it came from First Dibs, and First Dibs used to be a lot easier.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then it scaled.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think they sort of realized, like, oh, we should really be a part of this whole process, so you can't exchange contact information with vendors. You have to deal with them through First Dibs by their terms of service.
So I don't appreciate that.
No, because especially if you're trying to deal with shipping and the person in Switzerland, and they won't. It's like, oh, we can't help you on shipping because we have to use First Dibs's system, and it's this much, and it'll take 6 weeks.
Yeah,
and so,
no, it's a drag. It's a drag. It'll turn me off of the First Dibs a little bit.
What's your favorite thing you bought on First Dibs?
I bought it. This is, I think, pre-shift, right?
Right.
When it was, we just bought a country house. We've just actually moved again, not very far, within, 15 minutes away. And I had a really bad stomach virus, and I was looking for a hutch, something to, hold all of our crockery and crap. And I was obsessively going through all of the hutches there, and I would like take breaks to go vomit, and I'd return to the couch and just scroll through and then vomit. But I did find perfect hutch, which doesn't have a place in our new home. That was disappointing, but it was so right, and I guess I get a perverse thrill from buying things sight unseen, and is it or is it not gonna work in situ?
A safe risk to take.
I guess. It depends on how much the goddamn thing is. But,
antique roulette. Yeah, is it gonna work?
Yeah,
is it not gonna work?
You
don't ever know.
Yeah, so.
But I think there's also a premium. I think it's probably more expensive on that site because the vendors are probably paying some sort of a premium.
Yes.
I'm assuming they're paying some sort of a premium.
Yeah.
But I see stuff on there that are like, is this old door really worth $12,000? I'm not. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah.
Someone sent me a link. A vendor sent me a link to some stuff that my wife's great grandfather initially owned.
Oh, wow.
And they were like, we thought you guys would like to have this. And we go, okay. And it's just some like paneled doors.
Right, right, right.
And we go on to the thing on first. And it was like $160,000.
No,
we're like, you know, maybe not.
My husband collects hands. So I, whenever there's, his birthday's coming up. So, you know, I'm always kind of cruising for hands. And I was in between appointments in New York and I saw an attractive hand in the window and, you know, knocked on the door and I said, can I look at that? And the guy said, sure, sure, sure. And he had to go, I don't know, do something in order to find, I don't know, to get it. And he said, yeah, I think it's about $20,000. And I just laughed. And I said, well, then I won't be purchasing that. That's great. Thank you so much for your time.
So you don't want to sell this.
What?
Hand.
You know, yeah. He said it so casually. Anyway, like everybody's just dropping 20G on
you might have gotten,
a random hand.
You might have gotten the celebrity discount, which is like a 50%
yeah,
markup.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't know.
As a famous actress, she could probably have said or it was just fully
what?
$20,000.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, so. I feel like that sometimes with antique stuff, where it there's shops around town that have like upcycled stuff and salvaged things.
Yeah.
And there's some things where it just looks like they were about to throw it away.
Right.
And they're like, fuck it, and they put it in the corner and then just put like $1,200.
Yeah.
And they're like, you were gonna throw this away. Or like, yeah, but you might pay $1,200
yeah,
for this.
Exactly. We live our country house is near a city in New York called Hudson, which is pretty groovy, and they have there's a Warren Street's a strip of antique stores, and it's a hub for that kind of thing. So it's fun to just cruise, and we have a dear friend who has a store on the strip, and so we have kind of, you know, this inn. We have we've gotten to know everybody over the years. We've been there for a decade now, but it's fun. It's such an insular world, and they all just trade to each other.
Oh yeah,
there's a reality show in there that I would very much watch, but I might be alone.
I think a lot of people would.
Yeah.
I mean, if people watch the HGTV stuff, which, you know, my wife and I do,
yes,
I would watch an Antiques Roadshow. There's no reason on paper. There's no reason that show should have been a massive hit.
Right.
Of just watching
That's true.
Of just watching old people go, my grandmother gave me this tea kettle.
We human beings like crap.
We like crap. We like collecting things.
It's a material world. We are material girls.
But don't you... Huge points for your Madonna reference.
Well, yes.
But do you ever walk into one of those antique shops and you just see like a little old lady sitting back there just... You know, kind of, she's got like her little tea, she's got like her little coffee thing, and then like a newspaper, whatever, and you go, I get it. I completely could see the beautiful simplicity of just, because it doesn't really matter if you sell anything. It's like, this is just her little space to go to every day.
Yeah.
Her life is clean, simple.
I totally relate to that. And our friend Ben, who I was just talking about, it's so fun to go to his house because it's just, you know, he's always circulating the crap, and his house is just a storage facility for
the
stuff he's selling, and it's fun. It's like a wonderland in there. Where did you get that thing? Anyway,
That's what's great about it though, is that like rather than buying pre-made furniture, everything has a story.
Yeah.
And even if you don't know the story, you know that if it's been around for a long time, it has a story.
Yeah.
And then you are adding, I mean, like all this weird old stuff that we have, I think like we're basically just caretaking it for now.
Absolutely.
And in the stream of time, it will pass on to someone else, whether or not, you know, we have kids and give it to them, or it'll just dissipate.
For sure.
And we are just taking care of this stuff for now. And I kind of like that it's not ours forever.
Totally.
Do you have a place that was that way, or did you make it that way?
I grew up in a loft in Soho.
Got it.
And my dad is a... was a photographer originally, but was a contractor for the majority of my life. And so he was always building things. And he worked with a couple, Joan and Harry, who professionally, and they were kind of family friends. And then I was a kid actor and kind of made a load of cash. And so bought a loft when I was 18. And that was, you know, there was nothing in it. I had moved to L.A., when I was 14, and with always with the intention of moving back to New York. And when I moved back, I guess I was just trying to recreate the home that I had grown up in. So it never occurred to me that I would go anywhere other than Soho. And I worked with Joan and Harry to build it from scratch. It was very weird because I was also in my freshman year of college.
Oh, wow.
And so I was living in a dorm and then would come back to the city on the weekends to, like, oversee construction.
And were you embarrassed to tell your friends where you were going?
It was... There was something not exactly right about that. But and my grandfather... was an academic. He was a dean of art and architecture at Yale, the school that I was going to. And I was taking this like architecture 101 class that was taught by a pretty fancy, famous professor called Vincent Scully. And he happened to be besties with my grandfather,
who
died, you know, years ago. But so I was taking his class and kind of, you know, going back to oversee construction with my architect friends that I inherited from my dad. I felt... In some ways, it felt totally obvious and organic, and in other ways was perverse and like WTF.
But. Well, yeah, but what a strange mashup of identities you would have had at a time where people are, number one, haven't even really begun to figure out who they are, but are just starting to.
Yeah.
So you're an actor and also a property owner and a college student.
Yeah, no, it was strange. It was strange. I would stay at the Four Seasons while I was overseeing the construction. Oh God! And I remember they bumped me up to. This is a particularly kind of kinky moment in my life. I don't live this way anymore.
Sure.
I didn't know what was going on, you know, and but they bumped me up to this like. Preposterously lavish room, you know, the presidential suite or something. And everything was gilded and there were just sweeping views of the city. And I was rewriting some English essay. And it turned out to be a really good essay. And my teacher kind of called me to his office. I thought I was in trouble. I don't think you call them teachers at college, but whatever. And no, he said, like, this is an exemplary essay and I want to use it as, you know, for in future classes. And I was like, it's just because I was in the presidential suite.
It just had a great effect.
It was just a really expensive venue.
It just absorbed,
and it seeped into the quality of the homework.
God, that's fantastic.
But, yeah, so it was funny. It was like, just totally credit the room
that's
for the success of that one homework assignment.
If you could call down to the concierge and say, do you have a lit paper writing writer on
tutor?
Staff?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Anyway, the thesaurus in that room was particularly
But the,
fine,
the problem with that is that it sets the president that you get superstition. You're like, do I have to be in the presidential suite every time?
I mean, college costs enough as it is without having to, you know, write every essay. And
hey, kids,
like
Claire's
Whatever.
Tips. If you want to write a better paper.
Kind of horrifying, but I apologize.
You know what? Any kid, listen.
It was weird. It was weird.
You have to apologize for nothing. Most kids who are famous and have money at that age are doing horrible things.
I wasn't doing blow. Doing homework.
Of all the things you could have been doing in the presidential
suite. I tucked into the gummy bear stash from the mini bar.
I didn't care which thing I took from the mini bar. The chocolates, the gummy bears, the waters, the $12 waters.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Exactly.
We worked at MTV at the same time.
We did?
Yes.
I never worked at MTV, but my so-called life was picked up by MTV.
It was picked up by MTV.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But you did a bunch of MTV.
That's true. I think there must have been some affiliation, or I was just a teenager at the time. You know, that was when MTV was...
Super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
It was super cool.
I did a show called Singled Out, which was like a dating show.
Yeah, I remember.
And the girl who was the co-star on your show, AJ Langer, was my girlfriend.
She's now like a duchess.
I know.
Yeah.
I haven't talked to her in like 25 years or so, 20 years. But we dated, and then she went and got that show, and then I started working on this other show.
That's funny. I didn't know that.
Yeah, but it was, that was my first brush with like, oh, someone that broke up with me is on a show. Oh, I gotta see. Oh, but I have a show too. Yeah,
that's funny.
It was fun. But I that show was great.
Thank you.
And was exemplary of that period of MTV when they were. Maybe this is an old person thing to say, but they were doing really cool stuff at the time.
Yeah.
Like that was a very authentic, when you kind of see what they ended up doing in the later years, or it's just like, oh, we're doing these hybridized reality things.
Right.
That was a really nice scripted show for young people to identify with that was really well done piece of television.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I credit all of it to Winnie Holtzman, who wrote it, and Ed Zwick and Marshall Hershkovitz, who produced it. They had done 30 something and it pretty amazing sensibility, but yeah, no, it was really, rare. I think it still feels kind of rare, and it's had an incredible afterlife. It keeps kind of circulating and, I guess there are like 30 and 40 year olds now who had grown up with it, who are showing it to their now 15 year olds. And so it continues to, I don't know, it lives on, which is great.
That's nice to hear, because sometimes when you watch stuff when you're younger and you're like, this thing's the best ever, and you watch it again, you're like, oh, I don't know.
No, this holds, is it.
But that
holds up. I think it holds up. I'm still really close with Winnie, who wrote it, and she's like my fairy godmother, and a lot of the cast members and stuff. So yeah, it was very lucky that was my first gig.
I'm actually surprised that it hasn't come up to reboot it in some way or continue the story or...
Right. I think there's been...
That character would have... have a kid by now that's in school.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure she does in an alternate universe somewhere. But, I don't know. Anyway, I don't know.
What if we just announced it right here?
Yeah.
You know what I've found in our culture is that if you just say things are true, you don't have to really back it up with anything.
That's been the case in the last year and a half.
You can just say whatever you want.
No.
It doesn't matter.
It's all up for grabs.
It doesn't.
Literally, Jesus. Pussies and fact.
Yeah, that's an album title or a book title or something.
Something, you know.
How did you, and I never want this question to sound obnoxious when I ask it, but how did you grow up in the business the way that you did, and you know, writing an essay in the presidential suite and then just turn out to be like a normal, regular, like nice person. Like it's just maintain, like, what, how does a young person navigate that world and still stay grounded, I guess is the better way to ask it.
I think my parents probably have everything to do with that. I don't know. I mean, I guess I got a little bit dizzy for a minute when I had to stop acting for a while, and college kind of afforded me that chance because I didn't really go to high school. I was tutored and was just starting to kind of feel strange. I needed to reset a little bit and kind of, I don't know, figure out who I was. Without playing another character and, you know, with the pressure of carrying a huge project and all the responsibility that entails, and also to just kind of hang out with people my own age.
Right.
Which is pretty crucial. And the last time I was in school was in like junior high, which is just a nightmare, right? So, I was a little bit phobic of girls because the last time I had really any experience with them, they were at their peak, like of vulgarness and like evilness. and I didn't kind of, you know, evolve through that with them in real time, you know, because everybody kind of softens and becomes more human over the course of high school, I think. I needed to go back to college to realize that was like a developmental phase, and that was just not the truth about all girls and women.
Right.
So that was really important. And I don't know. But yeah, I think my parents just I grew up, as I said, in New York and danced as a kid and really loved that. But, you know, I was really clear that I wanted to act, and it just came out of freaking nowhere. I mean, my parents were tolerant of that, you know, more than that. I mean, as I said, they had been artists, so they understood what it was to have creative urges and things. And they were had, you know, wanted to kind of support me in my pursuit of that. But nobody knew what it actually meant or what it might lead to or anything. You know, my brother played basketball. I did this. And it just kind of collected momentum, but it was really self-driven and motivated. And I, you know, found this junior high school for performing arts and went to it and met other kids who were acting professionally and kind of got a sense of what one would have to do in order to, like, make that happen for real, and got a headshot and sent them out to agents. And, you know, and then there was, like, traction, you know. It's, and I think my parents, everybody was just sort of bewildered. And they weren't going to, I mean, I clearly loved it, and they didn't want to, you know, harsh my mellow. But nobody could have envisioned that it would result, you know, in, like, this, in doing homework in the presidential suite or whatever. But, yeah, so, and it just collected momentum, and then we kind of found ourselves in LA totally, like, shell-shocked. But by the time My So-Called Life happened, there was some kismet involved, because it just kind of naturally worked for my family. My dad's construction business was ending, and it kind of, we had to go through Chapter 11. It was just like a natural endpoint for him. And my mom was kind of, she had run a toddler school in our loft growing up, and she was kind of ready to move on from that. My dad, my brother was 7 years older, 6.5, 7 years older, and was already in college. So, like, we could kind of pick up and move.
Sure.
We were all available, you know, to that experience. And, So it was fortunate, and then we moved to LA literally the day after that massive earthquake.
Oh, yeah, I was here for that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it was wild, because, like, that was just so apt of a metaphor for how we felt in general, you know? And but then the earth was literally shaking.
Oh, yeah.
Because there were all these aftershocks. It was a weird way to arrive. Anyway, but so we were all just kind of like, huh? Yeah. And then, you know, my parents were really protective of me. They were always on set. They always made sure I had a tutor. It was a given that I would go to college. I mean, I think there was no resistance from me, and that it was just clear that was going to happen. And, I don't know. They're great. I mean, they, as I said, I dragged them out here and they stayed. So I live with them when I'm out here. They live in Santa Monica, and there's a yurt in the backyard.
That's nice.
And it's so great. My parents, like, drove me to Soul Cycle this morning.
Oh,
and my
that's
dad
so
picked
sweet.
Me up.
Oh, that's so
yeah, I'm 39 years old.
You still should have been like, drop me off over there. I don't want to, not in front of everyone.
Yeah,
drop me off
totally.
Over there. I'll get out over there.
But, like, what kind of reality is this? Who knew?
That's so sweet,
it's
though.
It's very sweet.
Oh,
and
you're
it's,
so lucky,
I'm
though.
So lucky. I really know how lucky I am.
But I can't believe that it coming out here the day after the earthquake, I think, would have made most New Yorkers go, oh, no, fuck this place.
Like, yeah.
Because when you haven't experienced an earthquake before,
right.
You don't – I mean, and every area has its own kind of – its natural disaster monster, whether it's tornadoes or hurricanes or
– Well, we didn't have a choice. I mean, we were contractually obligated
to stay wherever
the hell we were.
Got it.
After they were filming. But we didn't have the presence of mind to reject anything at that point. We were like, you know, we were just so overwhelmed by, this huge shift.
And you probably, you know, listen, it was a great time to just get free furniture that people were throwing out on the curb.
Yeah. Well, in New York?
No, here.
Yeah.
Because stuff.
I guess so. I don't know. But. Anyway.
Do you have a child now?
I do.
How old?
And he's 5 and a half, and I'm pregnant.
What?
Yeah, I'm like Yeah.
Congratulations. Thanks.
Yeah. And my third trimester and everything. Like,
Oh my gosh.
I'm like hella pregnant.
I honestly wouldn't have.
Yeah.
I swear.
It's all here.
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And so do you know?
No, I'm not carrying in my calf. I'm not one of those women. No,
not a calf baby?
My stomach. It's right in the stomach. So stupid.
That's where it goes?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the traditional place. You know, the traditional place?
In the womb.
Wait, that's a choice?
Yeah.
Well, I can carry this.
I think in 10 years it might
be. In 10 years it could be a choice. Yeah.
Grow it over there. I don't want it in my body. I don't want it in my body.
If it can happen, the Kardashians will figure out how to, like, grow a baby on a tree.
She had placenta accreta.
What is that?
She had to. I think that's why. Well, anyway, I know too much about this.
I didn't even know.
We all know too much about
it. I didn't even know. I was just making a, if there's a way to make it some
She had a baby by surrogacy, I think, Kim, but she had to for medical reasons. It wasn't because she wanted to keep her body intact.
Oh, got it. So it must be true.
I think in my OBGYN's office, you know, people
magazine. That's how you could do that now.
Yeah.
Do you know if you're having a boy or a girl?
I don't. But I have a boy now, so I'm in the business of boys. I'm surrounded by penises.
That's what,
already. So I'm ready for more.
Taken out of context, that might be weird.
No, I know. Even my dog, you know, is a boy. So
that's fantastic. I talk about this with my wife all the time because she's like, I just want it. Her sister has three little girls, all like under, like five and under.
Uh-huh.
It was just like boom, boom, boom. Right. And she's like, I just want to have girls. And I'm like, fine, but. She says they're so sweet when they're young. And I go, yeah, but they get tricky, like 13 to 18. She's like, yeah, but boys destroy everything. I go, I know, but they only do that until about 13.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just – it's the whole thing is outrageously wild and weird. And you just – like it does, none of it makes any sense. I try to explain – you know, because obviously I'm pregnant. And we had to tell Cyrus, our son, how that worked and stuff. But it doesn't – I don't buy it.
No, like, not on board?
What? No, surely that's not what happens. And surely there's not another human being growing inside of me right now and kicking me. Like, what? It is so sci-fi and so incomprehensible and so, amazing. But boy, girl, I mean, the whole thing just blows my mind anyway. I'm just excited to meet whoever this, like, freak is going
to
be.
It's funny that it's so easy to carry the anxiety of, like, oh, my God, I don't know if I could have a kid. Then what would happen? Like, you know, people have been having kids for a really long time.
Yeah.
In periods of, like, in eras, you know, like during the dark ages where people really probably statistically shouldn't have thrived.
No, that's the other kind of paradox. And it's the most ordinary phenomenon. And it is just, surreal and mind bending. And
it's so funny. Yeah. I realized really way more recently than I should have, but just when talking to my wife about having kids and kind of going, I don't know, it feels like everything's going to change. And I go, wait a minute, neither one of us drink. We never go out anywhere.
Right.
What
right.
really is going to, you know, like it's
yeah,
not.
Yeah, it does change. I mean, it breaks everything wide open. Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to have all the answers all the time.
Well,
you're expected to have all the answers
all
the time.
Well, they do ask a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
But no, you just make shit up all the time. Yeah, you pretend to know. No, that's not true. Yes, it is. You just lie to them constantly.
That's what I heard the trick is. And then later they go, you told me this. You're like, oh, I was full of shit.
I try to not lie. I try to tell him I don't know. And then he doesn't accept it. So he drives me to, like, make some fiction up.
It's
like,
not your fault.
Yeah.
What are you supposed to do?
I don't know. But, yeah, I'm acutely aware of my limitations. That's what I've gotten from parenthood.
I'm curious, since you have one little boy and since, you know, obviously – everything that's going on in the world, culturally, socially, you know, where there's these grand shifts in the way that just gender relations and gender identity, which kind of goes back to the movie that you're here to talk about, Kid Named Jake. But, you know, what steps can you take as a parent to instill the types of values in your little boy to treat to not sort of fall prey to the old way of, you know, the way.
I mean, I think, look, my mom had this toddler school in my loft growing up. So I grew up with a gaggle of, you know, 1 and 2 year olds running mm-hmm. around. And I think I knew early on from that experience that, you know, they are who they are. And girls often gravitate towards like the dolls, and boys often gravitate towards the sword. I mean, our movie's exploring the fact that, and we're all waking up to the fact that that's not the absolute norm, you know, or given. There are variations on the theme.
Right.
But I think, you know, of course you can actively, consciously instill values, and that's something you're always negotiating with your partner, hopefully. But the fact is that they are just modeling the behavior that you can't be that aware of. I mean, they just take everything in. They just do. And you just have to kind of live. they hold you to some account, I guess, sure. In that respect. Like, I mean, you can only be so vigilant, but if I feel like a jerk, I'm going to want to kind of check myself for the sake of my, you know, Cyrus.
I guess it is kind of a tiny mirror that if your kid does something if your kid's a dick about something, you're like, what did you?
Oh, yeah.
And then you realize when did I?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh no.
Yeah. So, it's pretty confronting, but yeah, so I think we're just screwed. It's all going to be horrible. No,
That is kind of the that's one of the sort of the tenets of this book written called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck,
right.
Which is not really like to never care about things, right. But it's just sort of the idea of like, well, if you know that everything is inherently kind of fucked up,
yeah.
Then why stress about it? Like, if you know that, you know, things are messy, like, just embrace the mess, ultimately.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, there isn't much of a choice. but, yeah. So, I don't know.
Are you a neat person? Like, do you have to have things in order? Or
I'm becoming more of that. The nesting impulse when you're pregnant is real. That is a thing. As I said, I'm constantly kind of moving around, and we bought a place in the village about 5 years ago, and the renovations have just ended. Head into microphone. While I was on location this last season of Homeland, all of the, you know, construction workers hauled their gear out, and so I was able to kind of fully claim the house, and I hired professional organizers.
Nice.
And that's where I want to spend all of my pennies. it was not cheap, but it was entirely worth it. It was amazing. And I just stare at the labels now. It's like my happy place.
Have you read the KonMari?
My friend just gave it to me because I was like having a moment mm-hmm. with this stuff. I haven't actually opened it yet, but yeah. But I've heard her on a podcast. Does that count?
You know what? That's the same as reading the book and understanding the philosophy. Of course it is.
I know that I'm supposed to hold something and
see if
it
brings you joy.
And I just let it go and thank it. That helps. So I've appropriated that without having had actually read the literature.
Just as a joke, you should share with your family what that is, and as a joke, every once in a while, you should just sort of grab your husband and go, yeah, I guess I'll. Yeah, I can keep you for another.
He's still good. He's still good.
Well, All right.
There's a lot of life in this.
Just keeps them on their toes.
Yeah.
Keeps them on their toes.
But I had a theme party. And so there was one birthday party where I had people wear the thing in their closet that they have an irrational attachment to.
That's genius.
That they should have rid themselves of long ago, but they just can't bring themselves to. It was pretty fun. And,
What was yours?
Mine was, Oh, God. It was the first article of clothing I bought with my own money. I was 11. And it was a pair of electric blue overalls that were capri and had a really wide waist
okay.
for no reason.
No.
They were like clown pants.
Okay.
And they had like little symbols on them like surfers and said, fun, beach, something. And there were two completely senseless, useless like metal hooks and like just where it got fat and wide. And I wore these amazing overalls with purple tights
uh-huh.
and long purple shirt. And my Doc Martens, I think.
You know, I don't see a problem with anything you're saying.
No, I thought I looked amazing. So I wore those with the purple tights and all. And when I was 6, I had an alligator hat.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of went out. Like, yep. It actually kind of snapped. And I wore it obsessively because I think I got a lot of attention in it. People say, oh, look at that girl in the hat, you know. So I liked it for that reason. And so I wore my alligator hat. And I also, in my 20s at some point, bought a phone purse, like a rotary purse that you can actually plug in and use. It still works. So I wore all of those things at the same time. And I was so happy. Yeah. But
how did you wear those to the party? Like, how did you wear if the overalls were...
Oh, I mean, I'm the same size that I was when I was 11. Basically. Yeah. And they were very wide and baggy. So it wasn't a problem. And the hat still kind of worked. I guess I had the same size head as I had when I was 6. And the phone, could... Yeah.
That's fantastic. The phone
purse, yeah. So Hugh, my husband, wore like a white wool Valentino suit. He looked incredible and I looked insane, but...
He was bullshitting.
Also it's true. Like it's like when would anybody ever wear that? But I guess he acquired it along the way somehow.
But that's almost kind of...
It's like when, you say my fault is that I'm a perfectionist.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I'm too much of a giver and I find... That's my flaw.
Yeah.
Is that I'm just too good of a person.
Yes. Yeah, like, I know.
Come on, stop it. Who you don't? Yeah. You don't have to humble brag.
Yeah.
You don't have to humble brag. The most irrational thing you're attached to is a white Valentino suit.
What would you wear?
Oh, I know I have stuff that's survived. Like when you every time you move and you're like this again, okay. Like right. You just can't. I'm sure it's probably. A pair of shoes or an old t-shirt or... Oh, you know what it is? It's probably like an old pair of bowling shoes. My dad owned a bowling center. And
I know that about you because I've listened to a podcast.
What?
Yeah.
So I must talk about that a lot. You just heard a random podcast. Like, my dad was a bowler. Hey, well, listen, it's not... I don't think it's a brag. But it's probably like an old pair of bowling shoes or some like old bowling thing that I have. Or an old bowling shirt.
Yeah.
That I will never be able to wear.
I love bowling shoes still to this day.
They're great.
They're kind of amazing.
They are amazing. You know, if you just don't think about the ones at the bowling alley having had tons of feet in them, then it's
but
okay.
But they in and of themselves are kind of great. There's a company called John Vluvlog,
mm-hmm.
and they were very popular in the 90s. And I still have, enormous affection for them. But that aesthetic was a little bit like bowling shoes.
So. Oh, yeah, yeah. That's kind of when... In the 90s with like grunge stuff and recycle, vintage stores really like that was around that time. Mm-hmm. But I think also it's weird being in comedy because you will acquire things and be like, oh, maybe I'll do a sketch someday where I have like a crazy Hawaiian shirt. Maybe I'll do a sketch someday where I have this like weird skin tight 80s snake suit, like a snakeskin suit. That I did a video for something and I had it and I was like, if I ever need, and I'm never gonna, I'm not gonna just break out into a fucking sketch show, but I could.
Right.
If I ever needed to.
Well, I think we should make that happen.
I feel like I should just get rid of stuff. Doesn't it feel good? It just feels good to get rid of stuff.
It feels so good. It feels so good. Yeah.
I think we're due for a purge here because we had very little stuff when we moved into this house and we just started acquiring and now.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to see and appreciate what you have if you have too much of it. I think that's one of the reasons why it's good to edit just so that, because you stop, I don't know. Like if I have too much too many clothes. I don't know where to start or, you know, and I end up wearing the same thing day in and day out.
Yeah, I have like racks full of really great shoes, and I won't stop wearing these.
Right, you know.
These Adidas shoes that are like 15 years old.
They're great.
They're comfortable.
Yeah. Nothing I'm wearing is mine, so I'm in the middle. I'm going from a thing to a thing.
Oh, got it.
All of this is pretend. Yeah. So, I don't wear these every day.
What?
No.
You don't wear these stylish pumps every day?
The white stilettos. No.
Not? No. What? Mm-hmm. So when you're working on something like Homeland, are you able to, like, once you have a child and your brain is probably halfway at home for most of the time, mm-hmm. or wherever the child is, what sort of skill sets are you learning as, like, okay, I can focus and be at work and focus on this, because obviously the subject matter mm-hmm. is very intense, mm-hmm. but I still, like, popping, do you have to learn how to jump back and forth between modes pretty quickly and easily?
Yeah. It's tough, though. I mean, actually, a big storyline this season on Homeland was Carrie realizing that she kind of had to surrender her daughter, you know, give her daughter legally to her sister, that she couldn't kind of reconcile doing her work and raising her child. It was, you know, it had to be one or the other, and which is obviously very painful. But there's this climactic scene, and I guess towards the end of the season, where she has to kind of say goodbye to her daughter without really letting her daughter know that that's what's happening.
Right.
And there's this line where she says, you know how mommy has to go away for work sometimes. And I was just rehearsing the scene, and I couldn't stop crying. I couldn't stop freaking crying.
It just hit some
deep. Yeah, just – and I'm not like that. Like, I'm in control of my craft. But it just triggered something. And, you know, I ain't no Carrie Matheson, right? But I just didn't kind of understand how loaded that negotiation or that conflict is for me. And I think for every mom, it's like – it's brutal. And we pretend it isn't. You know, like you just go and you just do and what you need to do. But it's painful. And the kid is fine. It's like, hey, Cyrus is no problem. But I did, this was the first season where Cyrus didn't come with me on location. He's five now, and my husband's doing a series called The Path that yep. happened to be filming in New York. And, you know, Cyrus was in, like, big boy school now, and so it just made much more sense for them to be based in New York and for me to be, like, the satellite parent. And we were shooting the majority of the season in Richmond, which mercifully wasn't too far away. It was the same time zone, and, you know. But I was, you know, shuttling back and forth, and I was really nervous about it. And I did this little – my mom said about me at one point, all Claire needs is – a joke, an idea, and a hug.
Just in life?
Yes.
So you need a joke, you need an idea, you need to be inspired by something, and then
hug, right? So, which is kind of true.
Yep.
But okay. And so I thought, okay, well, while I'm away, I'm going to – so I made this like little canvas container, and there were three compartments, and I decorated it with Cyrus. And so every day that I was gone, I put like a joke in one of the compartments, you know, of an idea, like a fun fact, and a hug. And one was like a little stuffy on a with the little hook, and then there was a plastic garland, and he could hook them on, and then a bead, and then over time he would make a necklace, you know. So like. But that really worked. That was good. But when I would come home, he would be so annoyed that he wouldn't get his, like, stuffed animal. I could see that I was a sorry replacement.
When are you going back on location? Yeah, wait a minute.
Exactly.
Come on now.
So that worked a little too well. but you do things like that.
Mommy was crying in a trailer because of you.
Yeah.
This simply will not stand.
Yeah. No, it wasn't even in the trailer was so embarrassing. It was like in front of the whole crew. I couldn't stop crying. And then Amy, who played my sister, you know, another mom in actual life, and you know, and then she went, and we were like dominoes, you know. And we could, it took a while to kind of get a grip, but yeah, no. But meanwhile, Cyrus is totally fine,
totally fine,
and just wants his stuffed animal.
And so, yeah, so the path is Michelle Monaghan,
yeah,
and Aaron Paul, and like two other really nice people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good gang.
It's nice. It's nice to. It's nice when you see other nice people doing well. I'm like, oh, you're making your thing, and you're nice, and you got a good family, and everyone's cool. Like that always makes
true,
me happy.
Actually, that's true. There, everybody in that the show is no more. It's not continuing. Sadly, they had a really good time with it, but you know, it's fine. But yes, no, it was a good little community, and everybody was pretty well adjusted.
Yeah,
shockingly, playing people who were not so well adjusted.
Not at all.
Yeah.
That happens a lot where you see people, it's like, you know, if someone's a dick on a show and then you meet them and you kind of have this weird little, you know, we're just animals.
Right.
So you're a little predisposed to be like, but then you meet them and they're like the nicest person in the world. Right. Fuck. Why are you so nice in person?
Yeah.
You could have been a dick and it would have been fine.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all have our moments.
But well, that's what's scary is that if you have a human moment at the wrong time, mm-hmm. that can instantly and you spend a lot of time. You might spend a lot of time going, no. I was just
right.
I didn't sleep, and
yeah.
I was really stressed.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
wasn't.
Yeah.
And people like, nope, fuck you.
Yeah, but I think you know the range of human moments is important to define.
Yeah,
like it's one thing to be a little short tempered or something. It's another thing to like send out a hateful, racist text.
Oh yeah. That's not what I was referring to.
Yeah.
I was talking about, in my mind, what I was talking about is, my friends harassed me a lot because we were traveling to Portland and there's a bakery there and they have like my favorite ham and cheese croissant thing and we were just there for a day. And I'm like, we got to go there as soon as we land in Portland. I went there and they didn't have it. And I was like, but I came all the way here.
That's
and
really annoying.
So I think about like if someone had captured that moment, guy's a fucking dick.
Yeah.
They're like, yes, I was being a dick, but I understand I was also stressed and tired. And that's what I was thinking of. I was not thinking about
that. I was just trying to excuse myself. Like, well, at least I didn't do that.
But I'll probably talk about A Kid Named Jake for a minute because it's a beautiful movie. And Jim Parsons is the sweetest.
He's the sweetest and so crazy talented, man. He is a really he's a seriously gifted actor.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah. And he's so technically proficient and dexterous,
mm-hmm.
you know, like he's kind of virtuosic with like the rhythm of language and timing. I mean, he's done some comedy in his day, but he's really so soulful too. And that combination is just really kind of extraordinary. So I had the best time working with him. And he's a love bug. Like he's such he can be, you know, an asshole too, in the most charming way. but no, he's just wonderful. I'm just such a fan of him on every level. So it was really fun. And who knew we would be like a credible married couple? But like totally worked.
Well, and because your director worked on Transparent, yes?
Yes, yeah.
And is also trans.
Yes.
Silas.
Yes.
And I think it's a great story because it is something that I think parents should be paying attention to and listening to and accepting whatever identity your child is. But also being able to tell that story of this parents who on paper seem to be you're like, oh, they're very liberal parents.
Right,
they're very
right.
cool with everything. And yet, you know, still trying to struggle to understand and also maybe overprotect.
Right.
The intentions are all really
right.
No one has bad intentions,
right?
But that doesn't always mean that just because you have good intentions that you're always making the best choices 100% of the time.
Absolutely, yeah. I think there's a lot about the movie that's really topical and timely, and we're thinking seriously about gender and you know how it works, and we're all kind of reimagining that as a cult, you know, and in our culture right now, which is a huge undertaking and a beautiful one. And I'm so glad for it. But yeah, it all seemed to happen very quickly. And I think we're all searching for the right language and the right way of kind of making sense of this huge shift in consciousness, right?
Right.
That we could, you know, be born as a boy and identify as a girl. Like, that's a radical idea that we're assimilating pretty quickly. So it's about that, but it's really kind of just a portrait of a family and a marriage. And it's called A Kid Like Jake, but it's really not so much about the kid. It's really about everybody around the kid, particularly the parents. And I recognize being a mom of a 4 or 5 year old that it's a big seminal moment in that little person is becoming kind of an individual and individuated and autonomous on a different level. And they're entering the world, and your little bubble, has kind of been burst open. It's like I think of it as like an exit from Eden kind of thing.
Right.
And I think they just start feeling self-conscious about, you know, suddenly like their child is getting labeled and evaluated. And,
oh, yeah, other kids can be so mean because there's just that automatic tribalism instinct.
Yes.
Of like, I'm superior and you're them and yeah. I'm us and we're, it happens so early.
It's all fine until suddenly you're kind of in relationship to society,
right.
You know, and institutions and, you know, and other kids who might be mean or something, you know, so, and I think they both are kind of taking that in and experiencing that in different ways. And they're a little out of sync with each other. Jim and my character there's conflict and discord and it just made sense. And I think, you know, that thing that could make that child vulnerable in this case happens to be gender related, but it could be anything, you
sure.
know? And I think we all see the vulnerability in our child and have a moment where we go, no, you
right.
know, and try to run interference and realize that we can't exactly. So I don't know. I thought it's really beautifully written and the dialogue just feels so real and relatable, and it was fun to play with my friend Jim.
That's great. Well,
yeah.
I thought you guys did a great job, and I thought Silas did a wonderful job. And it's really fantastic. I have an animation studio. And my business partner, is trans, I adore her for so many reasons. But I said to her one day, I said, you know, the thing that I hope this doesn't come off as condescending or arrogant, but I said the thing that I love about the trans community so much is that it's hard enough just as a person figuring out who you are
right.
and establishing your identity. It's hard enough with that.
Right.
But then on top of that, if you know, the fact that you were able to make a choice that you know is not going to be an easy road
right.
and you make that choice anyway,
right.
like it's one of those things when I talk about it, I almost get really
yeah.
emotional about it because
yeah.
I just feel like it's just hard enough without
yeah.
having to pile on the idea of gender
Absolutely.
Identity and the idea of like what people's stupid prejudices are and
yeah.
that sort of thing. So it's, you know, but to come at it from the standpoint of the parents where you know your kid, you have to let them fall in,
mm-hmm.
at times to learn. But then at a certain point, you're like, oh, but that's a little too much. Like that
right, right.
that type of
right.
that the type of vitriol that you can face from other kids, that's a little too much. So
yeah.
then what do you do?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it was so funny. Like just before I got the script, I was at the playground with my son and my husband and I were sitting on the bench watching him play. And there was another child, short hair and glasses, but a big tutu. And I said, oh, I think it's just a really tomboyish girl. And then that child and her brother seemed to come over. We had a dog, Ouija, with us, so, you know, a magnet. So they came over to talk to the dog, and I was making conversation. And I said, are you brother and sister? And there was a long pause. And finally, the kid with the tutu said, yeah, we're brother and sister. And then later it became clear that, well, their dad came over and sat next to us. And so we were talking to their dad, and he was gay, and he said, no, that's my son. And he is adamant about wearing dresses and tutus, and he's going off to kindergarten in a week. And I, actually the school that I happen to go to kindergarten, you know, PS3. And I'm not going to let him wear the dresses when he goes to school, because I don't want to expose him to, you know, to hurt, basically. He said, look, I'm gay, but I grew up in a very different time, and I just don't know what, I don't know how to do this. Like, I don't know how to respond to this. And then my publicist's sister happens to teach at that school. And then I got like feedback later. And so that little boy is going to school, and there's Tutu Tuesdays.
Oh, that's great.
And it's like, fine, you know? So they've all figured it out. And, you know, none of the kids care, you know, but it was just so interesting. It was like this experience just dropped out of the sky. You know, it was the kismet was kind of wild.
You were tuned in?
I was so, I guess so. And then I got this script and I was like, wow, that is so, I really was just thinking about exactly that. Literally 2 days ago. So yeah.
I think that's amazing. And, yeah. And my wife and I have talked about this before. Like, we just, whatever our kid wants to do or be, we're happy with. The only thing I wouldn't be tolerant of is if my kid wanted to play sports, because I don't understand sports. But outside of that.
But it's interesting. And I think why this movie is kind of great, what you started the conversation talking about, is, you know, it's one thing to, you know, be liberal and tolerant, you know, and it's another to be presented with this reality, you know, in such a direct way, and to be to be raising a kid who might be experiencing this, you know, and maybe those that ideology doesn't line up with your natural impulses, you know, and I think that's okay. I mean, it's okay to be scared initially, because of course, and actually Silas was great about this. You know, he was very sympathetic towards these characters who were a little rigid and defensive and reactionary initially.
And did he want that? Like,
well,
was
he
that
wanted
sort of
to, he wanted to portray it in a way, you know, like he was not condemning of that response. You know, he had like real compassion for that response, which relaxed me as an actor who's going to be playing that, you know? And it was so kind of generous of him and like gracious of him. But yeah, I think it's all right. And you kind of got to just move through it. And the only way to be reassured is to, like, you know, live it out and realize that there will be such a thing as Tutu Tuesdays, and, you know, that your kid is going to be fine. But
that's great.
But I can see how that would be unnerving.
Well,
actually,
I'm glad that I'm just happy for that. I'm glad for that.
Yeah,
child that
right.
Gets to be who
I
they
mean,
are.
I mean, it's also lucky that, you know, New York is generally, yeah, it's never a given that it's going to be okay. But New York is one of those places where you might find more forgiveness more easily.
Well, I think this is what a therapist would say. I think we're at the end of our hour. Really good work today, Claire.
Thanks.
You really opened up. Let's try to not spend too much time in the presidential suite. I'm not sure it's healthy.
Right.
That's not where your success lies.
No, it lies
you
in the yurt.
You are responsible.
It lies in the yurt.
Oh my God, the perfect, the presidential suite or the yurt.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest, I just don't, the yurt's great. My reports just, they're just not as good. I don't know what to say. The yurt's great. The yurt's great. It's like, you know, if the yurt could have the presidential suite in it.
Right, right.
Is that okay? Yeah. Can I be yurt? Can I be a presidential yurt?
It's a pretty good yurt. It's like the presidential suite of yurts.
Of yurts.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, that's fantastic.
I
mean, so just put the gummy bears in there.
Yurt's horn, but.
Easy with the yurt tooting. But when is it out? A Kid Named Jake, is it out
it's
yet?
It's coming out soon. I think it comes out tomorrow in New York and then other places like within the week.
June 1st.
June 1st, tomorrow, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I think that's, is it tomorrow?
Yeah.
It's June already? God damn it, how does that happen?
Well, you have like 6 hours left of May. Enjoy.
What am I going to do?
I don't know.
God damn it. But I can't thank you enough for being here. This was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
So much fun chatting with you.
So nice to talk to you, and so fun to see your stuff.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thanks. And, you know, tell all the antique shop owners in your town That because my wife's mom doesn't live too. I don't think she lives too far from there.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. And so
she must know.
She
the
must.
Strip.
She must know all about it.
Yes.
She must know all about
yes.
it. So maybe yeah. we'll come up and have a visit.
Okay, that would be nice.
And buy a rocking chair from Little Lady in your town.
Yes.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Yes.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.